Well, for most people, March Madness usually means college basketball, but for weather watchers, it means a contest among all 50 states to recruit the most volunteers. We'll talk about what it takes to be a volunteer weather observer, and then we'll look at spring weather trends in Wisconsin. One of our guests is Taylor Patterson. Hi, Taylor. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, yeah, it's good to be here.
Taylor is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Alongside her, for now, is weather guy Steve Ackerman. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
Hello, Larry. Good seeing you again.
Steve directs was director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He is a professor of atmospheric sciences and also has a couple of other roles as well. He's vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Our other weather guy, John Martin, will be joining us around the top of the hour. But Taylor, let's turn to you first. There's something called COCORAS. What does that stand for?
Yeah, so COCORAS stands for the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. So it's basically just a community-based volunteer network of weather observers, and this network spans across the entire United States.
Yeah, how did this network form?
So this network first formed back in 1998 in Colorado. Basically what had happened was one side of the city had gotten a whole bunch of rain, like a foot of rain in a few hours, while the other side got almost none. And so then the resulting flooding in Colorado caught a lot of people off guard because they didn't think they had gotten a lot of rain. So COCORAS is striving to create a network that has a lot of rain and snow observations to better help forecasters and as well as like farmers and other people that use our data, like water resource management as well.
Yeah. Well, Steve, you know, why is it important to track these data?
Oh, well, as Taylor was pointing out, precipitation is really, really on a small scale. So I lived in Colorado for many years. I knew the state climatologist who really got the whole COCORAS going. And you could see it in Colorado in particular because it's so flat, but and they would get a lot of thunderstorms. And so you could literally see one side of the road completely dry, and then 20 yards down the road, it's just soaking wet. And so unless you have a high density of precipitation measurements, you really won't get it until it gets into the rivers and the lakes and begins to cause flooding. And so it's really important to get that measurement as accurately as we can. We can get that with radar, but these sites, I believe, are also used to help calibrate the radars as well in terms of rainfall amount.
And so, Taylor, how do meteorologists like yourself use these data then, and kind of the way Steve was describing it?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it is used to help calibrate the radar as like the big number one. The radar does give us an estimate of how much rain is, but it's a rather complex math equation. And so to actually have ground truth can help us adjust those measurements.
And
it's really interesting. Yeah, there are a number of observers in the city of Madison. There needs to be more. But when you get a thunderstorm, it's really interesting to go on to this site. It's a very friendly website and really look at the variation across the city. It's really quite amazing at times.
And what's that, Taylor, maybe you can tell us what's the, how do we get to that site? It's COCORAS?
Yes. It's COCORAHS.org.
So, rah-rah. It's COCORAS.
Yes.
.org?
Yes, .org.
.org. And so I'm hoping, I'm guessing a lot of people are going to go right to that and take a look at it. COCORAS. There you go. So do you use Who are there other people using this besides yourself, did you say?
Yeah, so there's a lot of other people that use it. Water conservation and resources use it. Farmers use it. Their website is also very user-friendly, so you can go on and just look. So the public uses it a lot. There's a huge end user base that uses this data.
So tell us about this March Madness contest going on right now.
Yeah, so for March Madness, all of the states go out and we try to recruit the most weather observers. And over the last 2 years, we have collabed with Minnesota and had a friendly rivalry between the two of us because there's a few National Weather Service offices that cover both Wisconsin and Madison. So Wisconsin and Madison. Wisconsin and Minnesota. Oh, man. So we've been partnering with them. And we've been very close over the last few years with Minnesota taking first over the last 2 years and then us being in a close second.
So if I'm listening to this and thinking, it might be kind of fun to be a weather observer and get involved in this network, what do you have to do? What are the activities that you should perform in this capacity?
Yeah, so what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to go to cocoraz.org, and you're going to want to sign up. We highly encourage everyone to get a rain gauge from CocoRoz. It is, I think, around $30, which I know can be a lot outright, but you get a 4-inch rain gauge. So that can hold almost up to 12 inches of rain at a time. And then basically we just ask people to go out and check when it rains and report their zeros if it's not raining. And you can do that at any time of the day, ideally. But on the report, it says to do it in the morning, I guess, if that makes sense. So most people are reporting between 6 and 8 a.m. on their way to work and just worked it into their regular morning routine.
Okay, and so it's rain. What about snow? We have to worry.
Yeah, so for areas with snow, you're going to want basically a yardstick or a ruler over 12 inches would be ideal, just in case. And then a flat surface to measure on. A lot of National Weather Service offices and other places will put a snowboard out, so that way they can measure every day. But if you have a spot on your deck or in your yard that you can routinely measure and keep track of it, that is another way to report snowfall.
Yeah. So, and you need to, I'm trying to think of how you do this. I could do it. There's a flat board sort of that's part of my landing area. Would that be a spot that you could measure snow from?
Yeah. I mean, ideally you don't want it too close to your house because then you might get some of the snow on your roof that will fall in that same spot. So as long as it's not too close to your house, I mean, ideally it could be a good situation.
So Steve, what do you think makes a good weather observer?
I think anybody who's enthusiastic about it. And so, if people are listening, if they have kids who are interested in the weather, the snowfall measurement is a challenging one, but the precipitation one is really easy. And it's a really easy way to get engaged in making a science measurements and contributing in terms of citizen science to what's happening. So I can't tell you how many times in the summertime, in the winter, I take my rain gauge in because I don't want it to freeze and break. But in the summer, when thunderstorms come through, when there's 4 or 5 observers around, it's really kind of fun to see how it varies.
How many observers do we have in Wisconsin? Do you know offhand, Taylor?
I think the last time I checked, which was probably before the start of March, we had around 480 observers spread across Wisconsin.
480. And so if a person signs up, goes to CocoRoz, CocoRahs.org, do you immediately become one or what? What happens?
Yeah, so you immediately become an observer. obviously, if you don't have a rain gauge at the time, it can be a little difficult to start immediately. And like we do encourage people to buy the official gauge, so that might take a little bit of time in shipping and getting it to you. But you can, in theory, start right away.
Okay, so once somebody signs up, they're in, and you've got one more person for that March Madness.
Exactly.
We want to beat Minnesota. They took the axe in the football game, right? So we got to get the rain gauge.
We'll get the golden rain gauge. You should come up with some sort of rain gauge trophy that could go back and forth, Taylor.
Well, actually, one does exist. There is a trophy. It's not golden, but it moves around from office to office. Whoever has, or well, state to state. So whoever has the most in a given year will get it for the year next year.
And is there any kind of certificate or something you can put on your window that says, hey, I'm a, part of Coco Ross?
On the Coco Ross website, there are other things you can buy. There are stickers and T-shirts and other, fun stuff that they do sell, yeah.
And what is does the T-shirt have, a weather cloud with some lightning coming out of it, or what does it look like?
So their logo is... kind of, I guess the best way to describe it is a raindrop, but it also has a gauge on it, and sometimes there are clouds. There's a few different designs, really.
Well, I love it, and I hope we get, take a look on your website here over the next hour or so, and see if you get some people, and then shoot me an email and let me know, because I'm hoping that a lot of our listeners sign up for it. Because it sounds like a lot of fun, and it really doesn't cost much of anything. And you can be doing some really good for your own community. Taylor, thanks a lot. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Taylor Patterson, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Steve Ackerman with us right now. And John Martin will be joining us soon. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And joining us now, John Martin, professor, former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, hi to you. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Good to see you. Steve?
John, good to see you.
Yeah, good to have you both with us now. Well, the first day of spring was Sunday, March 20th, John. Why is this day that we transition from winter to spring?
Well, that's the day where the Earth's axis is kind of perpendicular to the plane of the ecliptic, and every place gets 12 hours of sun and approximately 12 hours of sun and 12 hours at night. It's the first day that the sun rises at the North Pole since about the time the Brewers were three games ahead late in the season. And the sun's down now in the South Pole. So pretty interesting day. But, they say the first day of spring is one thing. The first spring day is quite another. So,
And so how does the Earth's axis figure into this?
Well, the Earth's axis is tilted towards the sun during our summertime. And it keeps the axis tilt stays the same for the object, the Earth itself, as it revolves around the sun. But depending on where it is in its orbit, it's either pointing towards the sun, pointing away from it in the northern hemisphere, or not pointing at all one way or the other. And that's where we are at the equinoxes. I think I said the wrong thing. It's that the Earth's the tilt has nothing to do with the length of the day for just 2 days a year. And that's both of the equinoxes.
Okay. By the way, if you have questions or comments for our weather guys, or maybe you've got a video or a photo you want to share, a weather photo, I'd love to hear from you. You can call us, though, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Steve, why do meteorologists use March 1st as the starting point of spring?
So as meteorologists, as professions, we're going to break the year up into four seasons. And so in order to do that, you know, you could break it up by the number of different days, but it's a lot easier to break up each season as a month. And so in the U.S., you know, our coldest seasons are December, January, February. So that's winter. Winter is followed by spring. And so those 3 months are March, April and May, I guess. Yes.
Okay. So last week I was doing my show and it was snowing and I can look out my window to the outside and there were snowflakes falling that were about the diameter of a golf ball or maybe even a little bigger. I mean, they were large.
Yeah.
Large, John.
I'm on the radio.
What, how do we get, why do these, what conditions cause these beautiful large snowflakes to form and perform for us?
Yeah, that perform is a great word. I agree with that, Larry. They're spectacular events. What's going on there is, and it can happen at any time during the winter. It has to do with the temperature of the air and the nature of the snowflakes that's affected by that temperature. But these snowflakes on, I think, Wednesday, I was down in Florida that day, yeah. So I missed it. But I saw them on Friday. They were good on Friday, too. They are covered with a little bit of liquid water because some of the ice has melted. And that allows adjacent snowflakes to stick to them. And so you really have conglomerates of these gigantic number of snowflakes. I don't know what the record is for actual ability to look through like under a microscope and see how many have attached themselves to each other, but I bet it's hundreds on days like we had Wednesday and then again on Friday. And so, you know, these dendritic snowflakes, the kind that you kind of draw as a first grade at Christmas time, are six-sided and all that. They have antlers effectively, and they can kind of lock horns anyway, even when the surfaces of those flakes are not wet. But if you add a little bit of liquid water here and there on top of them, it's even easier for them to stick together, and they form these giant, almost pancake-sized snowflakes. But it's always an indication of the fact that you are skirting the fence, skirting the line on rain or snow. It's really close to being melted away to rain when you get those giant snowflakes.
Well, I would
Larry, I was on a meeting too with somebody and looked out my window and saw them too, and then everybody started sending me pictures, but. So I also looked into it, and as John said, he described the process really well. The biggest record snowflake, which is a combination of ice crystals, as John was pointing out, was measured in January of 1887 in Montana, 15 inches wide.
Whoa! Oh, my God.
That's a foot and a half. Well, not quite a foot and a half.
That's amazing.
How'd you like to look up and have that smack you in the face?
Well, it could hurt. It'd cover your face. It's like getting an eye in the face.
Wow.
Well, the interesting thing to me, too, that watching from my studio, and I was paying attention to the show, but I would look out occasionally. Sometimes the large snowflakes would come down, and then sometimes I'd look out, and it was little ones falling.
Yeah.
And they must have escaped, you know, being stuck together, which is possible. It's random at its hot, so some of them can make it through. And, in the depths of the winter when it's snowing and it's 10 degrees Fahrenheit at the ground, there's no chance they're going to stick because of water. And so more of them than not are going to be small and individual, but very different when it warms up like it does in late March.
Yeah.
Boy, I'd love to see one of those 15 inchers.
Yeah, me too.
Man, oh, man, oh, man. Well, listen, we do a Garden Talk program every Friday. And for all our gardeners out there, when's the last frost typically to arrive? You know offhand?
I don't know off the top of my head. Do you
say May 10th?
Mm. May 10th?
Is that right? Is that too early?
No, that should be about right.
I bet that's close to right, yeah.
I know.
Certainly, April people will start planting anyway, right? Usually, and then and then if it looks like a frost, you can cover things pretty well.
Yeah.
I went out this weekend and it was frozen still, although my tulips are coming up. So
mine too, yeah.
Yeah.
Mine are finding their way. But, the famous pictures occur of tulips with snow around them. So they're hardy enough to survive modest cold. I don't think if it gets really bitterly cold, they probably don't make it.
As an aside, if it's May 10th, don't plant your green peppers then, because they won't flower, and you'll get a nice plant maybe, but you won't get any green peppers.
Oh yeah.
I made patience that mistake is a virtue. Once. I wait till the end of the month, and I'm actually into June before I do it. Well, here we are. It's the windier time of the year, I guess, in some ways. Let's talk about wind. Is Wisconsin windier than it's been for the past few years? I know some people have been asking about that.
Yeah, that came up, I think, that when we did last week's show. And so I actually reached out to Ed Hopkins, who works in the state climate office, and he took a look at that data going back to back to 1948, I think it was, and looked at that time period up until 2022. And actually, our windiest month is the month of March. So I could see why people think, you know, March seemed to be very windy, because it is the windiest month. But when we look on the monthly average going back to 1948, is that what I said it was?
Yeah.
You'll see there's a definite trend in a decrease in the average wind speed over the month of March.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. So it's getting less, actually.
Well, you know, if you combine that with frost aid, I mean, is climate change, do you think, having an impact here?
I would render a guess, and that is that I bet you the same data set suggests that it was colder over the month of March over the state of Wisconsin on average, especially above the ground. In 1948 than it is now. And if that's true around the hemisphere, which I think for sure it is, perhaps it's that the wintertime jet stream is migrating poleward of us a little bit quicker than it used to. And so maybe the storms are not quite as frequent during the month of March. I don't know if that's it, but that's not impossible.
Yeah.
So it could be related that way, but that would be easy to test. And I've not done that.
We got a note from Tab from Mesa Maney. He's a Wisconsin gardener from the Madison area. He says he has a book, a Wisconsin gardening book. Now, who knows when that was written, but it says the last frost date is May 21st. And it could have been at the time of the book, and maybe it's different now.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, I would think it's, well, I know that the growing season in Wisconsin is lengthening with time because of global warming. They do put it in the weather almanac, so that could be a farmer's almanac, I should say, as well.
It's a good
piece of information that they do provide.
Right.
Yeah.
How do they calculate average wind speed?
That's a good question.
I think it's probably from, you know, there's an hourly observation at a first order station.
Right.
And they probably take the average of the hourly observations for the day. Midnight to midnight is my guess. So it's a local diurnal definition, I think.
They also do record the monthly average wind gust, which is probably a little bit more carefully done statistics. I'm not exactly sure if they do that with the maximum wind gust on a given day and then average those, or how they do that.
I bet that's a good question. I'll bet you for the daily maximum gust, it's just whatever was recorded on that day for that particular variable. I wonder how they average it for the month. That's a very, what does it even mean? That's a weird, that's a weird variable.
Yeah.
So what's up for, you mentioned a first order station. I think you said, John, what's a first order station?
Those are stations that I think are staffed by a person with a certain qualification as a weather observer. And they're probably also stations that are at airports, for instance, and others. And then there's other cooperative observing sites that are not considered in the same category, but I don't know exactly what the distinctions are. It might have something to do with length of record. It might have something to do with the nature of the observational tools and so on, and whether they've been checked out by NOAA as cited properly and all that. So it might be a whole bunch of things like that.
And as we look around across the state, how many first order stations might we have? We'd have them in Madison. We'd have them in Milwaukee. I assume we'd have them. I imagine they exist in the major cities of the state. So Green Bay, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's right. Steve, do you happen to know? I don't think I know how many there are.
The major ones, there's the four major ones done by the National Weather Service, and that's us, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and La Crosse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if there are other ones designated as Division I observing stations, though.
Yeah, I don't know either. That's a good question, Larry. I don't know how many are first order.
And I should give the number again if you want to join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. March isn't my, here we are getting into April pretty quick now. We're in the last Monday of the month. So as we think about severe weather, and tornadoes and that sort of thing. They don't, I mean, we have them in, I guess we've had them in every month or almost every month.
Mm.
In terms of the conditions and so forth, is that something that we start to think about more in the month of April?
I think not so much for the state of Wisconsin, Northern Illinois, Minnesota. I think that's more June, July, and August where it's a little bit more of a threat for us. And probably less severe of a threat than it is for some of the states south of us in this, April, May, and June phase, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Southern Illinois, places like that are under the gun beginning, first or second week of April, pretty much. And it migrates northward as the summer goes on. So we don't see our biggest threat till June, July, and August.
They've had some
severe thunderstorm weather, but of course, we do have severe blizzards and
high winds
in the wintertime.
Right.
And so
that's true.
There's always something going on in Wisconsin.
Right.
At a given month of the year, for sure, that we're concerned about.
That's why it's fun to live here.
Elijah in Appleton, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hello. I was just wondering, how do you calculate relative humidity?
How do you calculate relative humidity? Okay.
There's a couple of ways that can be done. I think the most straightforward way is to take a measurement of the mixing ratio, which you can get from, or the dew point temperature, actually, probably the easiest way. You know what your pressure is. You use a sling psychrometer, a device that where you wet the bulb on a thermometer and you don't do it on the other next to it, and you get a difference between the wet and the dry temperature, the wet bulb temperature and the dry bulb temperature. And then you take those observations and you can put them on a chart that's been created over the decades that will give you a really accurate measure of how much water vapor content is in the air to make those observations work. And then you can compare it against what could possibly be in the air at that temperature, and you get a really nice measure of the relative humidity. It's quite accurate.
Elijah, there you go. Thank you so much. John, who's near Rice Lake, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. We listen to your show every time we go from Rochester, Minnesota, up to our cabin around Stone Lake. But I just have a comment. We were talking about the wind. We were talking about the frost. And I saw a nice sign of spring as my wife and I traveled along 53. We saw our first mama bear of the season just a minute ago. And kind of sauntered down into the culvert before I could pull over and get a picture, but nice sign of spring.
Yeah, it is indeed. So it's that's near Rice Lake, so that's pretty far north. And if the bear are starting to come out of their caves, can spring be far behind? George Vukalik, rest his soul, always used to say the first sign of spring was when the Blue Jays came to Milwaukee. He was talking about the Toronto Blue Jays.
Oh,
because I've heard people look at the first time they see a robin as an indication of spring is starting. So there's a number of different ways to measure spring. I think I've never heard one about the bears. First time you see a bear, but that's a pretty cool way.
Are there other ways now that you brought it up, Steve?
I think there's a number of people, you know, who look at phenomenological, whatever, you know, how things are changing. Birds, people look at birds in terms of when the first time a bird arrives, like a bluebird, whether it's a baseball team or a real bird, robins as well. I start having hope when my tulips begin to show their greens, that spring is on their way. People also look at potholes, you know, because the springing, the thawing causes a lot of potholes. And so pothole season is also looked at by some as beginning of spring.
For me, it's one of two things. It's either 3 days in a row, 60 or higher, or my recognition that I'm already behind in my backyard. Yeah. One of the two, you know.
Well, you know, if you left your plants and so forth up through the winter, they say you should leave them up and don't clean up your flower area or whatever until you've had 3 days of 50 degrees in a row.
Okay, there you go. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of insect beneficials that live over winter in those areas. Mm. So there you go, 3 days of 50 degrees. Larry in Star Prairie, what's on your mind?
About thermometer accuracy. Talk to people and everything, and some people have, you know, 10 degrees difference in everything. And the local airport, that's where it's 10 miles away, and I figure that would probably be the best bet for accuracy. And where do you get the best thermometer for accuracy?
All right. What's the best thermometer for accuracy?
Yikes.
Yeah, that's a good question, buddy. I mean, if you're 10 degrees off, you should know it, or you're putting it in the sun if you're making an air temperature, which you shouldn't do.
Where do you place your thermometer outside?
So it should be in a shaded area that's well ventilated. So in that ventilation spot, a lot of times we put them in what we call a Stevenson box. So it's like louver doors all around it and painted white so that inside the box doesn't heat up.
Wow.
And I remember doing an experiment in high school, though it probably has to be done more carefully in your kitchen counter in terms of you want to set your thermometer. You know, we know what the boiling point of water is, and we know what the freezing point of water is. So, you know, if you put a thermometer in a boiling pot of water, if you're 10 degrees off, I think you would know that because it would be like, I guess, 2002 Fahrenheit instead of 212 Fahrenheit, which is the boiling point of water. So that would deal with the 10 degree problem, but not, you know, the 10th of a degree problem.
Yeah, I think that, you know, most, if you spend a little bit of money and you don't get the cheapest thing on the shelf at the hardware store, you probably get a decent instrument. But as Steve points out, it's the sighting that really can give you problems. And don't discount the fact that over 10 miles, there can be all kinds of local geographical differences and whatnot that really do account for substantial differences in temperature. We routinely here in Madison, the airport is in a little bit of a sunken glade. And the consequence is it is always colder on the coldest mornings by 6 to 8 degrees, depending on where you live in town, compared to the airport, which is the official observing station. So it's not at all uncommon for such variability to exist.
And the airport is flat, low.
Yep. It's a cold air drainage pool, so it really gets cold there.
So it's colder there than it is.
Yep, it sure is.
It's going to be colder there than most places. And if you're right,
one of the lakes, and boy, we're always in the summertime. We are always cooler than the city.
I'm betting right now that Lake Mendota side, it's a little colder there than it is on the Lake Monona side because Monona's open fully and Mendota is not.
That's probably right.
So on that happy note, guys, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your visit the last Monday of April. Oh man!
All right, it will definitely be some. Springtime then.
Yeah, 3 days over 60 guaranteed by then.
That's right.
Okay. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our weather guys, our guests, and they'll be back the last Monday of April. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.